Today in Studio 360, drug-induced mind control, pregnant teenagers, the murder of babies. This is the operating system underlying the seemingly perfect world of The Giver. A decade before The Hunger Games, Lois Lowry pushed the boundaries of children's literature about as far as they'd go.
I never sit down and think, oh, what will rile people up? I do think, what would make a good story? And this does, I think.
Lois Lowry returns to that perfect dystopia in her new book, Son. It's the conclusion of the Giver series. And has a kid's movie ever really inspired you? Finding Nemo made one of our listeners pack up and move to Mexico.
A whale?
A whale!
You know, I speak whale.
Dory, this is not whale. You're speaking like upset stomach.
That and lots more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today I'll talk with Lois Lowry, the author of The Giver, which, after Harry Potter, may be the most widely read work of contemporary children's fiction. And we'll hear a story about the artist Romare Bearden, whose jazzy, colorful collages helped define African-American art in the 20th century.
What Romare did for me was show me what an artist is. Here was a man that created up until the last couple of days of his life. I mean, he just never quit.
But first, let's talk a little about how the culture just keeps going more and more digital. Your record collection, your TV, your books, and now, movies in theaters.
007 reporting for duty.
Bilbo Baggins. I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
You really believe this story? Osama bin Laden?
You probably haven't even noticed it, but in the last few years, most movie theaters have installed digital projection systems. That's right. When you go see a film in a theater, usually you're not seeing any film. As with every shift from analog to digital, this one's got its winners and losers. For the movie studios, digital dramatically brings down the costs of distributing films. And the image stays pristine since there's no film to get all scratchy and schmutzy. But lots of smaller independent movie theaters just can't afford the costs of converting to digital projection. Brent Lang has been reporting on digital conversion for the entertainment industry news site The Wrap. Brent, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me, Kurt.
So this transition to digital projection started some time ago, but theater owners say that 2013 is when push is really coming to shove. How come?
First of all, something called virtual print fee agreements, which are basically a deal that studios will pass on some of their savings to theaters who do this conversion in order to cover the cost of conversion. Well, those agreements are set to expire at the end of 2012, many of those. And the second thing is that now we've sort of reached a critical mass in terms of the number of digital theaters that are out there, and that means that it might not make any more financial sense for studios to continue producing film prints of movies, of new releases.
So people know, I think, how prints, film prints work. These cans of film come and they're loaded onto these big, often horizontal projectors and projection booths, and they're shown. How does digital work? What does a theater get when they show us a digital movie?
I mean, I believe it can be anything from, you know, something you get as a thumb drive to, you know, something that eventually will be sort of beamed to your system. The major thing is it will save studios an enormous amount of money in terms of shipping and processing. As much, I believe, as $1 billion a year.
Wow.
That's the estimate.
That's real money. At this point, what fraction of movie theaters in the United States have made the transition?
Well, the majority of movie theaters have made the transition to digital. There are about 5,700 movie theaters throughout the country. Roughly 2,000 of those theaters have not converted.
Wow. And for the most part, are those, is that whatever, 40% who haven't converted, are they smaller theaters? Have all the big chains, the AMCs and Lowe's and the rest, converted already?
They're well on their way. These are not the people, your Lowe's, your AMC, your Regal. These aren't the people who are facing, you know, the choice between do I keep the lights on, the marquee on, or do I close my doors? Those are independent theaters.
Because basically this year or very soon after, if you're a theater and you don't have the ability to project digitally, you're just out of luck. You're not going to be able to get a studio to send you film anymore.
I have talked to a number of independent theaters who've said that already they're feeling the pinch, that, you know, if they want a new release, they're having to wait longer for the film prints. The studios aren't making as many of them, so they're in demand. And when they do get them, frequently they're not as good quality as they were just a few years ago.
Presumably there will be movies that don't exist on digital. What about the library? What about the repertory houses still around? What will they do?
In New York, something like a repertory theater, or Los Angeles, something like a repertory theater is a more viable business. You know, many of these theaters are small town theaters, frequently in remote locations, and they're not doing, you know, a retrospective
right.
look at the films of Orson Welles. Their bread and butter is new releases.
And when we're talking about an independent theater, what kind of costs are we talking about to get the digital projection equipment?
It ranges. So it's anything from $65,000 to $150,000 per screen. You know, some of the theater owners that I talked to told me that, quite frankly, even if they wanted to do this conversion, they can't get a bank loan to do it. Their business isn't big enough to justify that kind of thing.
That's Brent Lang. He's a reporter for the entertainment news site The Wrap. I wanted to find out more about the problem of small theaters in remote locations converting to digital projection. In the little town of Fairbury, Nebraska, a couple hours from where I grew up, the owner of the Bonham Theater couldn't afford the conversion, and he shut the theater last summer. Now, a group of locals called the Bonham Theater Project is trying to reopen it. They're taking donations, even accepting in-kind donations, like some farmers' grain. Debbie Ebke is the group's treasurer.
We're attempting to raise the money not only to buy the digital equipment, but also to remodel and upgrade the interior.
Right. Why did you and your fellow townspeople get involved in this? Why is this important to you?
Well, I think it's very important for many small towns to maintain any type of entertainment venue to keep young people and young professionals in our community.
Yeah, I can see how this would have an impact beyond the fact, oh, it's just another small business leaving town. I can see how it would feel like, wow, we're not really a town anymore if we don't have a place where people can go and consume entertainment together.
It also impacts our economics in the town itself. When we travel 30 miles to go to Beatrice to see a movie, we might also eat out, or we might go to their retail establishment
right.
where that money could be staying in Fairbury. So it's an economic issue for the whole town.
And are you getting good support? Is this striking a chord?
It is. And I think there are some people who have kind of hesitated, and they're waiting to see, you know, what the next step is before they contribute large amounts. But we have quite a few donations coming. So it has been a good response, and I think it's just the beginning.
And are people really donating livestock?
Well, so far we have not had livestock, but we have had people with pledges of grain, farmers that will deliver grain to the elevator in the name of the Bonham Theater Project.
Wow. Go Cornhuskers. I wish you good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking with me. Debbie Ebke is the treasurer of the Bonham Theater Project. That group is trying to raise money to reopen the Bonham Theater in Fairbury, Nebraska, and convert its projector from film to digital. So, what do you think? Should we care about small independent theaters when you can pull up practically any movie you want, recent or old, on your phone? We'd like to hear your thoughts. Visit us at studio360.org and leave a comment.
Sound like a scream. Hey, didn't you?
And speaking of movies...
Welcome to the Golden Globe Awards!
It's awards season. The Golden Globes are just a week away, and our annual love-hate fiesta begins. The award shows have kind of turned into parodies of themselves.
Wow, I'm so nervous. Thanks to my mom.
Mommy, thank you.
Say hi to my grandma, Bernice.
This is so cool.
Oh, please wrap up. You have no idea how much I'm not wrapping up.
Well, this year, we're embracing the cliché. We're creating our own version of bingo, but instead of B5 or G17, the squares will be things like uttering an FCC-prohibited word or bringing a drink on stage. It's Studio 360 Award Night Bingo, and you can play along at home.
Thanks very much.
Coming up first this Sunday, January 13th, during the Golden Globes. You can find out more details at studio360.org.
For any of you who don't know, the Golden Globes are just like the Oscars, but without all that esteem.
Still ahead this hour, Lois Lowry, who wrote one of the most beloved and controversial kids' books of the 1990s.
They feel the book is too dark and sinister and frightening, and I sympathize with that. But literature is a way that kids can explore what they're going to have to face when they're older, and they can do it safely.
The author of The Giver here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A couple of weeks ago, I asked if you had any creative New Year's resolutions, projects that you've been wanting to bite off but just needed the extra nudge. We've heard from more than 100 of you, such as Dahlia, who resolved to learn how to play the ukulele, and Nick, who wants to finish writing his novel about Amelia Earhart. Well, it is now 2013. And time for you to make good on those promises. My first call is to Michael Relland in Phoenix.
Hello?
Hi, is that Michael?
Yes, it is.
Hi, it's Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Kurt.
Thanks for writing into our website, telling us about your creative New Year's resolution. But before we talk about that, what do you do the rest of your time when you're not putting off creative projects?
I'm working with little kids on creative projects. I teach elementary and middle school instruments, orchestra, band.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that was the last time I played an instrument was in middle school, so I guess...
Nice, nice. So many people give it up, but we're trying to work with them on being little me expressors. That's what started me on this venture to write in, because I realized I spend my days teaching other kids to do this, and I realized I'm not taking the time for myself to do it.
Right, right. You've got to walk the walk as well as talk the talk, I guess.
Right, right.
So explain the challenge you've set for yourself for 2013.
Ooh, yeah. Play a recital, a big recital, me and the cello on the stage in front of friends and family in the community.
And have you figured out what you'll play?
Well, I mean, probably something from Bach and accompanying cello suites. That's a big one. That's the top of the mountain for most cellists.
Yes, I've heard Yo-Yo Ma do that. Is that it? That, if you're a cellist, is the thing you most aspire to try to get right?
It seems so. He wrote them as instructional pieces. So, again, we have this echo of myself teaching other kids to play. And they are a good mix of here's a level of intensity where you have to be very self-absorbed for many months to get it right, but it also really presents your own reflections, putting that on the table. So it's not just playing something difficult for difficult's sake. You know, you really can put yourself in those pieces, and I think that's what attracts so many artists to reinvent those.
But it's not going to be an all Bach.
No, I think, you know, a little Bach. There's some Russian sonatas I'm looking at that are very... hard on the sleeve, beautiful melodies, And again, you know, intensities that you'd have to really work at to get right.
And will you invite your students?
I think that'd be cool, yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking of having some of them play, and I thought, no, that's going to turn into a school band concert.
Exactly. I think you have to be the adult up there actually playing, and it's about you, not about, it's okay because I'm with these kids.
Yeah, sure. But having those kids in the audience would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of raise the bar in a certain sense. Not that they're necessarily the most rigorous critics, but, you know, here you are putting yourself out there like you're asking them to do every day.
Yes, true. Oh my gosh.
Don't get nervous. So as you prepare to do this, what do you feel like the biggest challenge or the most daunting aspect of this thing is for you?
I think asking others to come hear it. I mean, because most of the work I do is going to be just being the cello in a room. And it's easy to play in a room and be modest and think happy things about the noises I make. But to involve everyone else, to explicitly say you're an artist in some way, is more of a challenge.
Is your notion that this is a thing you sort of, you know, life got in the way and you put off performing for a lot of years, is this will be it, or this is part of a process of being more of a public performer?
I think it is a process. It's felt like that this whole time. It almost seems like a classic case of putting off a dream, and the moment is a good marker for me to build confidence, because that's what this is about. It's like note by note, mark the identity as a cellist, you know.
Well, and now you're going to have a million people around America hoping and expecting you to do it. So there you go.
Right, right. Stand on their shoulders.
Now, I understand you also just got married, so congratulations on that. I guess 2013 is going to be a big year of change all around.
I know.
A wife and your first solo performance.
Yes, and she's very much supportive of this endeavor. She loves to listen to me play. Even if it's, 6 o'clock in the morning, I can play.
You're a lucky man. Michael, thank you very much, and we'll be good luck with bringing this off, and we'll be checking back in.
Great, Kurt. Thanks.
We'll check back with Michael in a couple of months to see how his planned cello recital is coming along. And over the next couple of weeks, I'll talk to some more of you to find out about your 2013 creative resolutions. In the meantime, you can see what other people are hoping to get done this year and add yours at studio360.org.
All is quiet on New Year's Day. The world in white gets underway.
Lois Lowry was 40 when her first book for children was published. It was called A Summer to Die, and it's about the death of a young girl. She's also written for kids about the Holocaust. But The Giver, which she published 20 years ago, really touched nerves, winning the Newbery Award, selling millions of copies, and getting banned by school after school around the country. The Giver is about a town where everything's pretty perfect. Everybody has enough food, a job, a nice home. People are cheerful, well-behaved, don't argue or act weird. Then a boy named Jonas learns how that peace and order is accomplished with pills that suppress emotion and by discreetly terminating the people who don't fit in or aren't useful. Lois Lowry has returned to that perfectly sinister community in a fourth book in the series called Son. Lois Lowry, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi there. Thank you.
It's an interesting fourth in a series because it's in addition to being a sequel and the end of this series, it also exists in parallel time with the first book.
Yes, and the two intervening books exist in the same time but in different locations. So the boy, Jonas, does appear in those two books, but then finally in the fourth book, Son, he takes on a major role, and now, of course, he's a grown man.
It seems to be one giant book that you've published in four volumes over 20 years.
That's a long time, 20 years.
Yeah.
And I guess it could be published in a giant book, but maybe at some point they'll put it in a box and it will be a boxed set.
So the children in this community are assigned their permanent jobs at age 12 in a public ceremony, and then they're done with their birth families. At the beginning of Son, a girl is assigned to the job of birth mother. I want to listen to a little bit of the story there.
The next day, she walked alone to the dormitory attached to the birthing unit and moved into the small bedroom she was assigned. From its window, she could see the school she had attended and the recreation field beyond. In the distance, there was a glimpse of the river that bordered the community. Finally, several weeks later, after she was settled in and beginning to make friends among the other girls, she was called in for insemination. Not knowing what to expect, she had been nervous, but when the procedure was complete, she felt relieved. It had been quick and painless. "Is that all?" she had asked in surprise, rising from the table when the technician gestured that she should. "That's all. Come back next week to be tested and certified." She had laughed nervously. She wished that they had explained everything more clearly in the instruction folder they had given her when she was selected. "What does certified mean?" she asked. The worker, putting away the insemination equipment, seemed a little rushed. There were probably others waiting. "Once they're sure it's implanted," he explained impatiently, "then you're a certified vessel." "Anything else?" he asked her as he turned to leave. "No? You're free to go, then." That all seemed such a short time ago. Now here she was, 9 months later, with the blindfold strapped around her eyes. The discomfort had started some hours before, intermittently. Now it was nonstop. She breathed deeply as they had instructed. It was difficult, blinded like this. Her skin was hot inside the mask. She tried to relax, to breathe in and out, to ignore the discomfort. "No," she thought, "it is pain. It really is pain." Gathering her strength for the job, she groaned slightly, arched her back, and gave herself up to the darkness. Her name was Claire. She was 14 years old.
That is from Lois Lowry's new novel, Son, which is the last book in her Giver series. So when you were writing the first book and decided that these birth mothers would be impregnated at 14, did you think, here's a good way to rile up people? You could have made them 18.
I could have. But I write for kids, and kids want to read about other kids. They don't want to read about 18-year-olds when they themselves are 12. So I will say, though, I never in writing sit down and think, oh, what will rile people up?
Right.
It just is beyond my radar. I do think what would make a good story, and this does, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And, of course, as I said in the outset, The Giver has been banned and tried to have been banned from various schools. And that is always mentioned in articles about it and its success and you as if it's this great red badge of courage. How do you feel about that?
When it began to happen, it so took me by surprise because there seemed to me nothing bannable in this book.
Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, maybe there are things that are shocking, but they're not shocking in a way that's gross or started to say not frightening. But, of course, the whole concept is frightening because it's the concept of what we could become.
Right.
And that's a little sinister.
And there's a famously horrific scene and importantly so, in the first book of a baby being mm-hmm. put to death.
An extraneous child, yeah. They feel the book is too dark and sinister. And frightening. And I sympathize with that. I had kids and I have grandchildren, and I would like to protect them from everything in the world. But in honesty, I do think that literature is a way that kids can explore what they're going to have to face when they're older, and they can do it safely. But by and large, the challenges have begun to die away because there are other books out there now. This was the first really dystopian
right.
book for young people. There are now many, many others, and some of them are so filled with violence.
So The Hunger Games has overtaken you as something that offends people?
some people, I guess.
Yeah.
And I confess myself, I'm troubled by the violence in The Hunger Games, the fact that it's a story about children killing children. I find that kind of appalling. Though I can see why kids love it. It's a fast-paced adventure story.
Yeah.
And, you know, in recent days, we've all thought more and become aware more of how kids are so inured to violence.
Inured to fictional violence.
And games
yeah.
and movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of movies, I've just heard within the past couple of days that this book, The Giver, that they've been trying to make into a movie for 15 years is finally on the road.
Really?
They have producers and money and a director and a star, and so I'm hoping they're going to they say they hope to start shooting it in the spring.
Congratulations. We've got a scoop. Who is the star?
Well, the star is Jeff Bridges playing the title role, and as we speak, they're interviewing young boy actors for the role of Jonas.
And the title role in The Giver is this older man who knows all of the history that the rest of the community has sort of put out of its consciousness, has erased.
All the dark secrets.
Which is, to me, the most interesting and original part of your dystopian vision because, among other things, it's resonant with what one can see in the real world, a kind of ahistorical forgetfulness, right?
Certainly there has been a lot of that in the past, and it brings to mind those people still who, the Holocaust deniers, who suggest that such things have never happened and would like us to forget it and stop talking about it.
You didn't start writing fiction until you had a family and raised your kids up somewhat until your late 30s. How did that happen? Was that a burning desire you'd always had?
Yeah, I had gone to Brown to major in writing, but it was the 50s, and in those days it was not unusual for a woman. We called ourselves girls at that time.
And we do again, somehow. Somehow
oh, really?
Women call themselves girls once again, yeah.
Oh, okay, glad to hear that. Any rate, I was a girl still when my boyfriend graduated. And so I dropped out and we got married. I had a baby when I was 21, a baby when I was 22, a baby when I was 24, a baby when I was 25. So I had no time to pursue either further studies or writing, which had been my interest. And when my youngest child went to kindergarten, I went back to college. It took me 4 years to complete the two that I needed for a bachelor's degree. And then I went to graduate school, and all that time beginning to write at the same time. But that's why it took me so long.
You were an Army brat. You married a naval officer. Did that military life shape your outlook, do you think, as a writer?
I think growing up in the military, and I was by nature a shy and introverted child, and growing up in the military meant that I moved frequently, and I was always the new kid in school, or it felt that I always was. And I was tentative about making friends. I think that made me the thing a writer needs to be, and a very observant person, an introspective person, and a person who read a lot. So that served me well, I think. The fact that I then married into the military was just a coincidence, and then the fact that one of my sons became a military officer, also just a coincidence. But I will say that in writing about this community and The Giver, I did draw on my memories of Army posts, where we lived by rules and regulations, and the days were very orderly, and every evening at 5 o'clock, all of us, wherever we were, stood at attention as the flag was lowered each evening.
The sacrifice of young men is a theme in these books. The character Maddie, who dies fighting evil, and in the new book.
Well, that's a spoiler. Now you ruined book three for everybody.
Oh, well.
Only kidding.
And in this new book, I won't spoil anything, that the main character Gabe is set out for a battle that he's perhaps not entirely prepared for. You mentioned your son, the Air Force officer who died in his airplane 17 years ago. Has the pain of that infused these books?
Well, that's an interesting question. Certainly, you never recover from something like that. That pain is always there. I think I was not aware of this when I was writing this book, but one of the major themes of this book is the fact that this young girl, Claire, from whom the baby, as soon as it's born, is taken, spends the entire, I think, 400 pages of this book searching for her lost son. So I think the yearning of a mother for a child who is gone and who's lost is there and comes from my own experience.
Well, as I was reading this book, I thought it's called Son. I thought, well, this could just as easily be called Mother.
The working title, not surprisingly, was Birth Mother. I realized, and if I hadn't realized it, the publisher would have pointed it out to me, no boy is going to pick up and read, much less buy, a book called Birth Mother. And, of course, these books are books that appeal to adolescent boys as well as girls. So I changed the title before they made me change the title.
I like the idea, though, of 12 adolescent boys and girls getting a sense from an adventure novel of this profound parent-child bond that they're aware of if they're lucky, but maybe never think about and certainly don't see depicted in YA fiction very often.
That's interesting. I think it's true, and I've been guilty of it myself, I think, that often writers of books for kids try to get rid of the parents. They want to focus on the kids, the peer groups, the relationships of the same ages. There are many, many books in which the parents have sadly died in a car accident, or in the case of James and the Giant Peach.
Yes, happily died. Yes, Roald Dahl specialized in getting rid of bad parents.
Yes, yeah, and I did too in one book of mine called The Willoughbys, where the kids actually do away with the parents, but in a way that's quite amusing, in my opinion.
We never, not to be a spoiler, but in this book, there is a touch of ambiguity about exactly what's going to happen. There are hints that big change is afoot. That was a deliberate effort to leave some threads untied, I guess, on your part.
Well, I don't know if you're a fan of Homeland, as I have been.
Yes, I have been.
But Homeland on TV has just completed its second season, and its final episode leaves one thinking, oh, they wrapped everything up. And then you think, oh, but wait, they didn't. There's still... And I guess this book does the same thing.
Well, Homeland, of course, there's going to be a third season and probably a fourth and a fifth. But you're really not going to write a fifth book, are you?
I'm really not. And I think sometimes these TV series tend to go on too long.
Yes.
For reasons that you can understand, because
yes,
they make a lot of money for them. And I think sometimes book series go on too long. But I'm finished with this, and that may partly because I'm 75 years old. I don't have that many more years left to do this, and there are other things I want to explore.
Lois Lowry, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Lois Lowry's new book is called Sun, and it's the conclusion of The Giver Quartet. Our reading from the book was by Krista Ripple. Still ahead this hour, when the artist Romer Bearden was approaching the end of his life in the 1980s, he started to open up a little.
I got 30 hours of Bearden talking about the most intimate things when he was dying. He knew he was dying, and he wanted to talk.
Remembering one of the great American artists of the last century, Romer Bearden. That is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Austin is unquestionably among America's coolest cities, with a great music scene, a booming digital sector, various forms of idiosyncratic Texasness, and South by Southwest, the country's biggest and buzziest annual cultural festival. So we couldn't be happier that Studio 360 is now airing on KUT, Austin's public radio station for news and talk. If you're just tuning in from Austin, hello and welcome. Visit our website, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and let us know what you think. Romer Bearden is the most famous black visual artist of the 20th century. He was best known for his collage art, a kind of patchwork cubism incorporating scraps of wallpaper, bits of glossy magazines, pieces of fabric, and more. The Smithsonian's exhibition Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, is in North Carolina right now. That's where he was born in 1911. But he lived and worked in Harlem, New York City, where he made a name for himself, finally, in the 1960s. He kept making art into his late 70s with help from a couple of younger guys who never left his side.
This is December 5th, 1987. Recording a conversation at Romare Bearden's home while I'm giving him his daily morning massage.
That's a man named Russell Goings. He called Romare Bearden Romy. They used to spend Saturdays together at museums, and as Bearden's health was going downhill, Goings visited him daily and started bringing along a tape recorder to document the time they had left.
I got 30 hours of Bearden talking about the most intimate things when he was dying. He knew he was dying, and he wanted to talk.
How you feeling?
I feel pretty good, Russ. I feel pretty good.
Russell Goings was quite a figure in his own right. He held a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. He was a founder of Essence Magazine. And before that, he played football for the Buffalo Bills.
When Bearden took an interest in me, and he took an interest in me because he wanted to know about football. And he would say to me, come visit me.
You think the Giants going to be a spoiler?
What else can they be?
Some of them, their jobs are definitely on the line.
That's right.
He had only his wife, no children, and some cats. He loved his cats. I became the back. I became the gopher. His wife was running her business and doing various kinds of things, and I'd take him to the doctor, and he became dependent physically for stuff. Over time, he embraced me.
You want to chat about your relationship with Duke Ellington?
Okay, what can you say about Duke?
What can you say? I mean, you used to tell me stories about him, about you.
So he was always ready.
Always ready.
Always ready for something.
Romy's workout. We're on our way to Long Island City, and the next voices you'll hear should be Tebow, myself, and Romy as we enter the studio.
There came a time when Bearden, in the end of his life, couldn't work big anymore. He had to work small, and he needed help. So he went and found an assistant named Andre Tebow, T-E-A-B-O.
My name is Andre Tebow. I'm a collagist. That's all I ever have done. That's all I ever want to do. And to be with the world's greatest, what can one say? You know, if I wanted to play baseball, would I want Nolan Ryan to teach me how to pitch? You bet I would.
Tebow, I bought you some grape juice. You want some carrot juice?
No, I'm satisfied with what I got.
We were like the Three Musketeers, all for one, one for all. And Russell, when he would bring Romare to the studio, would give us directions as to how he wanted us to keep our heads down and the scissors and the pencils flying.
Romare and I get this all figured out. He basically got it all figured out. This will be done by next week. Huh? Are we cooking or are we cooking?
If it wasn't for Russell, none of this would be possible. The trek from Canal Street to Long Island City was not a simple task. His bringing Romare to the studio, caring for him, I mean, there was so much that he did that nobody was really aware of. I mean, how he got him dressed in the morning, how he at times would have to carry him down the stairs or up the stairs.
Andre Tebow caused a whole lot of controversy. Bearden is black through and through. He went and got a white assistant.
There were a few times when I would be working on a piece in his studio and a visitor would come by, a black man or a woman, and I often thought what they were thinking seeing me there and wondering, what was I doing there? Romare never discussed it. I never asked, but it was often in the back of my mind.
December 24th, 9:30, just completed giving Romare his massage. He's on his way down. I'm taking a large painting and collage of his to the studio.
Just run the tracing paper over that.
Over this entire piece?
To trace it, yeah, because I'll make a drawing from it.
And what you want trace, Romare, is around here?
No, trace all inside, because I wouldn't know how to do those little things.
Well, one phrase he used with me on a few occasions was, the art of painting is the art of putting something over something else. This was Eden Midnight. And it depicts an imaginary forest scene. The star here that you see was the last piece. When I was nearing the completion of this, he asked for a piece of yellow paper and a pair of scissors, which I gave, and he cut out that star, put it where he wanted it located, and his favorite words to me were, okay, Tebow, lay it down. I would glue it, put it down, and that's where it stayed.
If you're going to put it down, you put it down every day. You put it down whether you're feeling good or feeling bad or you're dying or whatever. You put it down until the very end.
I remember one moment. He was actually working on a collage titled At Low Tide. This was the last work that Romare Bearden had ever made. He never allowed me to assist him on that. I remember going next to him. He had dropped the scissors as he was working, and I picked them up. It was the first time ever that I noticed in his eyes, his gaze, that he wasn't far. So I handed him the scissors and he completed that piece, signed the front of it, signed the back, dated it. He said, I made this for you. What Romare did for me was show me what an artist is. Here was a man that created up until the last couple of days of his life. I mean, he just never quit.
Yesterday, Romy was lethargic throughout the day, very, very slow.
Man's dying. So, what does he want? Orange juice, some salmon, some grapes. A nice melon. What does he want? He wants scissors, glue, paper. What does he really want? It gives me, he wants a nice bar of chocolate.
This is January 26th. It is 8:30. I'm on my way to give Romy his massage, and today he's not going into the studio. He has scheduled 11 o'clock appointment, and I think it's a very important and crucial appointment with Dr. Coleman.
So once we get you in the hospital, you want me to leave? I should leave. I don't need to stay.
I don't need to stay.
There's no reason for me to stay, doctor.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Okay, I mean, not if I love you, but...
No, I meant I didn't want to run away.
Yeah, I told you when I came in this morning, you could dismiss me. I know how you love me. You already told me
yes? No, I mean, it isn't that. I didn't know this was going to happen. You know what I mean? I thought I could come back home.
I thought...
You didn't think so.
I didn't think so. They got to sit down and do some serious evaluation. You might need a little more blood. No telling what you need. It was too fast. Right?
Romare Bearden died just a few weeks later, in March of 1988. We heard from Bearden's close friend Russell Goings and from his assistant, Andre Tebow. WNPR's Katie Talarski produced our story. At Studio360.org, we've got a slideshow from this period showing the three men at work. The exhibition, Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, is touring the country, and you can find out where at Studio360.org. Every so often on the show, we hear your stories about works of art and culture that changed your life.
My name is Kiki Kenstra, and I'm from Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C.
Kiki had a solid office job. Then she went to visit her friends who were teaching English in Morocco, and it gave her an idea.
They were having a great time. They loved where they were. And then on weekends and long holidays, they were able to travel around and see the world. And I thought, I could do what they're doing. So I came back. I went to school full-time to get a teaching degree, and then I began teaching kindergarten.
And then Kiki sort of got stuck.
I taught for 5 years, and I had a network of friends and family. I owned a condo on my own, and I didn't have a big need for change. You know, everything was fine, so why rock the boat? I'm an adult with no children, so I don't generally see animated films, but someone had recommended it to me, and so I said, okay, I'm going to go see this movie, Finding Nemo. Finding Nemo is about a father clownfish who is widowed, and he has his one little baby, Nemo, and he's a very overprotective father.
Hold my fin. Hold my fin.
Dad, you're not going to freak out like you did at the petting zoo, are you?
Hey, that snail was about to charge.
But Nemo gets separated from him.
Nemo!
And the whole movie is Marlin, his father, on this quest to find Nemo.
They took him away. I have to find the boat.
A boat? Hey, I've seen a boat.
You have?
He makes friends with a fish named Dory.
Hi, I'm Dory.
Where? Which way?
It went this way. It went this way. Follow me.
Thank you.
And there's this one scene where Marlin and Dory find themselves stuck inside a whale.
It's a whale?
A whale!
You know, I speak whale.
Dory, this is not whale. You're speaking like upset stomach. What's going on?
The water inside the whale is going down, and they can't figure out what's happening. The whale is coming up, and the water's going down, and they start to hang on the tongue.
Dory!
Marlin thinks he's going to be eaten.
He says it's time to let go! Everything's going to be all right!
How do you know? How do you know something bad isn't going to happen?
And they let go of the tongue. And they get blown out the blowhole. And they're saved.
We're alive!
I realized when I saw that scene that I needed to make a decision about my life, and that staying in my life, just hanging onto the tongue, hanging there. I wasn't doing anything. And I needed to jump. I needed to let go and see what happened. I thought I could find someone to rent my apartment. I could do something with my furniture. I don't have to quit. I can take a leave of absence. So I just started setting the wheels in motion to go overseas. I ended up going to Mexico. I taught in Guadalajara for 2 years, and it ended up being one of the most amazing experiences of my life. So now I'm back in Maryland at my home, and I'm now teaching first grade instead of kindergarten, but in my 12 years of teaching, I've always taught mostly Latino children that don't speak English. And I feel that my teaching has gotten so much better because of my 2 years in Mexico, of me being the fish out of water, of me being the person not being able to speak Spanish. And I've really come back armed with better teaching strategies to work with my kids that are new to the country and probably scared. And I feel like I've gone through the same thing that they've gone through.
¡Estamos vivos! ¡Vamos a encontrar a mi hijo! ¡Señor Gracias!
Wow. That is Buscando a Nemo and Kiki Kenstra, who listens to the show on WAMU in Washington, D.C. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story with help from Jesse Taylor. Is there some movie or book or any other cultural work that actually changed your life? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org, and we may feature your story on the show. But that's it for this hour. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferum,
Alana Harper,
Alina Kuczynski,
Matt Liebowitz,
Jesse Taylor.
And a thanks in this new year, as in every year previously, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate. By Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
It was a half century ago that George and Martha came crashing into our lives in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Stop it, Martha.
And today, they're still going at it.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor.
I'll talk with Broadway's latest George and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Tracy Letts next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.